If you want to have fun in the sun out west, here's what we suggest. Meet me in Las Vegas.
All these people moving in and they found a utopia. Well, if they could stand 120 degrees during the summer, if that's utopia, then hell must be a utopia, you know. Could you see Satan saying, come on down here. I've got casinos. I've got machines. We'll all gamble. We'll have a good time. It's hot.
I'm Mark Levitt, and welcome to the 18th season of Action Speaks, underappreciated 20th century dates that changed America, produced by S220 in Rhode Island with the help from the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities and the law firm of Robinson and Cole. You're listening to us from the AS220 Performance Space in downtown Providence, Rhode Island, home of Triple Deckers, Artists in Lofts, and the confluence of the not-quite-so-mighty Winnesquatucket and Providence Rivers. With the United States still wrestling with the social and political fallout of an uncertain economy, and with apocalyptic-like weather events threatening our built environment, anxiety about our future is widespread. Because of this, Action Speaks has decided to look at moments in 20th century U.S. history where America's greatest hopes and despair have been represented in our country's collective imagination and construction. Our theme this year is Utopia, Dystopia, dates where traditional and idiosyncratic ideas for the transcendent met with the amplification of everyday horrific in a battle for reality. Today, our underappreciated date is the 1941 opening of the first casino on what would become the Las Vegas Strip, the El Rancho Vegas.
Luck be a lady tonight.
Our guests today are Dr. Larry Craig, Chair, Department of History and Political Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology, and the author of Bright Light City, Las Vegas in Popular Culture. Natasha Schuhl is a cultural anthropologist and associate professor at MIT's Program in Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. Her documentary film, Buffet, All You Can Eat Las Vegas, has screened multiple times on PBS and has appeared on numerous film festivals. And Dave Constan is a professor of classics at NYU and is the author of many books, his last being Before Forgiveness, The Origins of a Moral Idea. Before coming to NYU, Dr. Constan taught at Brown University from 1987 to 2010, where he was the John Rowe Workman, Distinguished Professor of Classics and the Humanist Tradition, and Professor of Comparative Literature. Welcome to Action Speaks, right here in downtown Providence. Nice to see you here. Have you been to Las Vegas, Dave?
Yes, I have, twice.
A utopian environment or dystopian environment or a little bit of both?
I'm one who liked it, so I have to say it was a fun place to be.
What did you have fun with? Tell me, I've never been there, and I feel bad about saying that and doing a show on Las Vegas, but it's not the first time I didn't have any real knowledge of what I was talking about.
Well, you know, you go there and every hotel is built on a theme. So you've got Paris and they've got a half-sized Eiffel Tower. You go to a New York hotel and it's got a Brooklyn Bridge outside. Everything in not quite miniature. You've got a Egypt represented with a pyramid hotel. So you can visit the whole world in one place. And I don't know that I want to live in one of those hotels permanently, but a few years would be okay. I could see that.
Natasha Schuhl, is that your idea of utopia, or is that even your idea of Las Vegas?
Speaking of the Eiffel Tower, the year before I lived in Las Vegas, so I didn't just visit, I actually lived there for 18 months. I had gone to Paris thinking that it was the utopia, and actually looking back, had an exhilarating but also pretty miserable time there for many reasons.
We won't go into that, right? We're not going to talk about that now.
No, okay. No.
Yeah, understand.
Romance.
I figured it has Paris, right? It had to have something to do with romance.
Yeah. And then I arrived in Las Vegas really expecting it to be the dystopia. And I didn't live on the Strip. I lived in a neighborhood You know, it's hard to admit sometimes, I had a very comfortable existence there. No exhilaration, but any time I wanted, I could go to the gym at 3 a.m. In Paris, I had trouble finding, you know, saline solution. The pharmacies would be closed at 6 and all weekend. Vegas, anytime you want anything, you can get it. So I don't know that I'd say it's a dystopia or utopia. I'd say it's a little bit of both, but I have to say that my experience living there was a very comfortable one, probably because I knew I was going to leave.
Larry Craig, you did a mid-career change. Your initial studies were in?
First quarter century of my scholarly life was as a scholar of New England Puritans. And in 1992, I took a trip to Las Vegas. And it was everything I'm not. As a scholar and as a person, I found that absolutely fascinating. So it's been, my 51 trips has been really an effort to understand Las Vegas.
And?
I'm still working on it.
Well, give us some insight. What's the appeal of it?
What really triggered my scholarly interest in Las Vegas was, why do ever more people want to go? In 1930, they had 125,000 tourists. They're now almost every year attracting 40 million tourists. And all the work I'd read about Las Vegas never answered the question, what draws ever more people to that city? And that's what led to the book Bright Light City, which was a study of Las Vegas as it's portrayed in film, television, novels, newspapers, magazines, and postcards.
Give us your favorite film about Las Vegas, and why do you think it had the appeal it did?
Oh, the first Ocean's 11. The first Ocean's 11, because although it was not a very good film, it's this wonderful time travel that you can see Las Vegas as it was in 1960, where all the hotels are 2- and 3-story buildings. And they're really just large motels with a wonderful marquee sign out front. Flamingo, Sands, Riviera, Sahara. But now they're dramatically different.
But it also, and Dave, I was going to ask you, did you see Ocean's 11?
No, I haven't. So
you never said, did you ever want to be part of the Rat Pack?
Oh, of course. I want to be Sammy Davis Jr.
And what was it about the Rat Pack that appealed to you and you think appealed to others who were attracted to Las Vegas at that time? In the would be the early 60s, early yep. to mid-60s, right,
Larry? Yeah, the Rat Pack played for about 6 years in a row in Las Vegas. And what I've discovered about their appeal was it was mainly an appeal to men. This was adults acting like juvenile boys, and they got away with it.
And so it's Frank Sinatra, it's Peter Lawford, it's Joey Bishop, it's Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr.
Sammy Davis Jr.
Natasha, before I want to ask you about the gendered nature of Las Vegas, but this idea of being able to construct the whole world in miniature to be able to get a handle on it seems like sort of the American Empire coming to fruition in some ways or another, because it's a way in which we begin to imagine that the whole world is within our ability to both comprehend and to own, essentially.
And in the process of folding these elements of the world into this kind of place, of course, the annoying, inconvenient, bad, dangerous aspects are sanitized out. I spoke to some of the architects for the Mirage, and in talking about their exotic rainforest and volcano, they said, "Oh, but this is a rainforest without the insects, and it's not really hot." And down the street, they're going to build New York, Brooklyn Bridge without the crime, etc. So it's definitely a very safe, sanitized play version of the world that's created.
How about this gendered notion of paradise, this Hugh Hefner, this
I would say that's still there. I mean, if you go to Las Vegas and you can see it not only with the cocktail waitresses and the out. I mean, we shouldn't kid ourselves that that's gone away. Yes, women are gambling, but the position of women in certain places in Las Vegas, including literally under your feet. If you walk outside of the casinos on any piece of pavement, there will be hundreds of flyers that get handed out of escorts and girly services, and you can just pick them up, and there's just pictures of girls with phone numbers on them. So gender in Las Vegas is still pretty problematic today.
So in a way, the early parts, Larry, of Las Vegas started in a similar way. I mean, of course, it was a place where the Paiute Native American community had a home. essentially amidst the springs. But the real birth and growth of Las Vegas was quite connected to this, quote, Sin City notion, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It was formed in 1905, roughly halfway between Salt Lake City and L.A., and it was useful for the Union Pacific Railroad. There was a wonderful opportunity to open bars because it's a long train ride and there's going to be a layover. Most of the first commercial establishments are taverns and bars, and very, very quickly they also had upstairs brothels. In fact, the city originally had one block, Block 16, that was where they restricted prostitution. So from 1905, it had that perception. And I saw it in the earliest newspaper articles, whether it's in San Francisco or Los Angeles, that they already had this sense of Las Vegas as that, almost like Reno. Reno's a little bit ahead of Las Vegas in time, but Las Vegas is kind of that forbidden city that when you get off the train, you just got to go sample it.
Dave Cunson, just as this miniaturization of the world, bringing parts of the world to the emperor's court, so to speak, there have been places, I suspect, where this kind of hedonism, so to speak, for lack of a better term, or gendered way of understanding paradise has been part of the classical tradition as well. Am I right?
Just look at any movie about ancient Rome.
Is that it's the way it was
they
in
don't
Rome?
Do it with the Greeks. The Greeks never get that kind of reputation. They've got another reputation, of course, but it doesn't turn up in the films as much. But when you get to Rome, it's always decadent.
And is there philosophies of pleasure-seeking that has to do with living a good life?
There were two pleasure-oriented philosophies. One of them said, increase your desires as much as possible and satisfy them as much as you can. That's what life is all about. That wasn't the Epicurean.
Can you go slowly? I want to write these down here.
But the Epicurean view has an interesting relationship to chance, right?
You mean in the swerve and things of that sort? Are you thinking about the way the universe is functioning? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, just to go with their doctrine of pleasure, they took a slightly different view. They said, when you've satisfied all your desires and all your needs, that's the greatest pleasure you can have. So you don't want to put your body into a state of pain and keep constantly filling it up again. What you want is to keep it at an even keel and ideally free yourself from superstitious fears, and then you'll be fine. So they call it static pleasure. Whereas these other school, the so-called Cyrenaic school, because they were centered in Cyrene, they had just the view that go for it and, in fact, exaggerate it.
I'm Mark Levitt, and today on Action Speaks, we're looking at the 1941 opening of El Rancho Vegas, the first hotel on what would be called the Strip, and how Las Vegas fits into our collective imagination as a utopia or as a dystopia. Our guests today are Dr. Larry Gregg. He's the chair, Department of History and Political Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology, and the author of Bright Light City, Las Vegas in Popular Culture. Natasha Schull is a cultural anthropologist and associate professor at MIT's Program of Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, and Dave Constant. He's a professor of classics at NYU, and is the author of many books, his last being Before Forgiveness, The Origins of a Moral Idea. Well, when we left, Natasha, you were saying something was quite intriguing. You were talking about the role of chance in the creation of a culture of pleasure.
Yeah, this whole show and its premise or topic of utopia and dystopia got me to thinking, what is the role of chance in Las Vegas in relation to that? And the sort of, if you want to think about it as Vegas 1.0, the kind of Rat Pack earlier days of Vegas, chance really was part of the allure. But it was accompanied and almost depended on the risk, right, that you would lose everything. What's often called action gambling, right, where you're in the heat of the moment and there's suspense and you're totally engaged. What you see today in Las Vegas, especially off the Strip, right, because there's people who visit and there's people who live there, and what you see increasingly around the country as sort of the Vegas model spreads domestically is a very different scene. It's people in front of slot machines, which bring in 80% of revenue, and they're pretty zoned out. And zoned out is the word that people use to describe why they were gambling. Not to win. In fact, some of the gamblers I talked to, the dedicated machine gamblers, said, you know, sometimes I get really annoyed when I get a jackpot because the machine freezes up and the music's playing and I have to sit there. Sometimes I just move right to the next machine and keep playing. And nowadays they design them so, you know, they're not even taking time to rack up because the designers have figured out that what people really are after is flow, the kind of predictable flow. So it's this real paradox. Another quote that I have at the front of my book, just to tell people where I'm going with my analysis, is a woman who said to me, you know, people always think gambling is about chance and that I'm sitting here like some dupe thinking that I can win against statistics probability. But actually, if you know, it's about the predictability. That's why I'm here. The real world is the place where I can't rely on anything, and it's totally unpredictable and scary, and that's why I come here.
Well, there's another piece to the chance proposition. So often I've seen in the films about Las Vegas and a lot of the novels, you have an awful lot of folks who show up and they don't know how to play the game, but they win anyway. So there is that sense that if you're a good person, you may have great luck on your side when you go to Las Vegas. And it's very much unlike what Natasha's talking about, which is something very, very recent.
So like, for instance, Jackson Lears, who's a historian who's written about gambling, talks about it as sort of the antidote to the Protestant ethic, that if you work hard, you're going to get rewarded. Mm-hmm. For Jackson Lears, it's almost a mystical sense that people believe that somehow the hand of God is going to come down, and just because you are who you are, you will be touched by it, and you will be rewarded for nothing particularly other than the fact that you somehow are at the right place at the right time.
Mark Twain described somebody as smug as a Christian holding four aces.
But let me trace this evolution from chance and danger to something that's more, I would say, and tell me if I'm wrong, Natasha, pacifying.
Right. I mean, Jackson Lears talks about this contradiction in American culture in general between what he calls the culture of chance and the culture of control. And early sociologists like the famous Irving Goffman, he was actually a blackjack dealer in Vegas, and he was put on the blacklist all around town. Interesting sidebar. But he wrote a
why?
Famous...
Why? Wait a minute. Why? Why was he put on the blacklist?
Well, because he was so good. So he had this whole idea that gambling was an antidote to the routinized, boring, humdrum life of like being an executive or a manager, and that you would go to a casino to interact with other human beings in this heroic way, and he called it character contests. And so Lears writes about this culture of chance, culture of control. I feel like the real issue today, maybe you said culture of passivity, I'd say maybe culture of escape, culture of self-medication, self-modulation. This is really how people describe it. One woman said, you know, Calgon, take me away. She referred to that advertisement from the 1980s. That's what she experienced at the machines, a kind of escape.
Is this a new notion, David, about how to live one's life to escape from the everyday world and sort of become pacified or medicalized against the indeterminacy of everything around you?
Well, there are novelties to it, I think. You're right there. But I would add a couple of factors. One is we have state lotteries almost everywhere in the country. So the culture of gambling has now become official. And people do it all the time, go buy a lottery ticket. They don't feel it as having the same countercultural or rebellious or secretive side to them. I would point out also that between 1965 and 2005, I noticed one change that struck me, and it was the move from the kind of slot machines that you had to pull on the lever, the one-armed bandit, to everything being done now by buttons. And that was, again, a different relationship, a more physical relationship to what they were doing, rather than what is now a bit like sitting in front of the computer. What I'm suggesting is that different attitudes are embedded in a larger set of cultural patterns.
Natasha, you addressed this in your book. Can you talk a little bit about
cultural and technological? I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's not just about, I don't think we can talk about these shifts in culture or sensibility without looking at the changes in the material environment and the different technological possibilities. So a lot of what we see today wouldn't exist without video screens and digital technology. It's not just the that what you see on the outside is buttons and screens, but what's going on behind the screens is maybe even more important. And designers of slot machines always told me, yeah, you can have the ergonomic seats and the special audiovisual sound cone and casino atmospherics. I mean, it really is a whole science. But the most important thing is the math. The old one-armed bandit, you would put in your coins and you'd bet on one line to line up one row of symbols. You would either lose everything or you would double, triple your money. Machines today, you'll see as this complicated pattern, there's maybe 100, 200 symbols on the screen, and you're dividing your bet, almost like you're spreading your diversifying your portfolio, which is a kind of related more to in sort of financial insurance than risk in many ways. You're minimizing your risk, ironically, by betting on 100 lines. So a penny machine, the most profitable earners for the industry today, ironically, you'll put in maybe $2 in pennies, bet on 200 different lines, and you're usually winning some back. So for the first time in history, you bet and you get a portion back. And every time you get a portion back, maybe a net loss, you know, put in 60, you get back 40. That's a loss. But you're winning on those lines that you get 40 back, so you get all the same audiovisual feedback. And there is some interesting physiological research on gamblers showing that people sitting there experience losing as winning. I don't think it's so much about the winning as the same. It's the same. It's the flow. It's the flow. And it gives them what's called time on device, or TOD. This is a very common word to hear in the world of machines.
Sounds like an academic career, actually. I don't know.
You increasingly see people from MIT and Harvard running casinos. The head of Caesars now, right? This is Gary Loveman, who's a who had a career, both education at MIT and a career at Harvard. They call them the propeller heads replacing the mob.
I wonder which pays more. Let's see, professor at MIT or designing gambling machines.
That's an easy one.
Let's get a question from the audience, and I want to get back to how the history of Las Vegas evolved to this, what sounds to be like a huge shift in how people are separated from their money and why.
Hi, I'm Mike from Providence. I'm curious about whether Las Vegas is truly unique. Certainly it was pioneering. I mean, I've certainly found things that you can only do in Las Vegas. I mean, I went to see Penn and Teller, and they were wonderful, and that's hard to do anywhere else. I get that. But from a gambling perspective, it's very difficult to see it as different from anything else. And in addition, from a food perspective, it's very difficult to see it as fundamentally different than anywhere else. Certainly from a climate perspective, it's purely awful. I mean, I was there, I think, the last week of June at one point, and the temperatures in the afternoon were about 110, 115. It cooled to about 95 or 98 overnight. And I thought, oh, well, I'm from New England. I just think it's ridiculously hot. But the cab driver is saying, oh, it's really hot. This is terrible. And there was some fire burning on the outskirts of the city, and there were flying embers and black soot in the air. I mean, it was a really unpleasant place.
Keep going. This dystopian vision is lovely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it was as if somebody dropped a bomb on the place. That's not the case. But it was a very unpleasant physical environment.
But actually, you just covered said something else wonderfully. Hold on a second. A bomb didn't drop, but indeed a bomb did drop near Las Vegas. Many of them.
About over 100. The atomic test site just outside Las Vegas. But to your point, the most successful developer in Las Vegas history, Steve Wynn, drew the same conclusion you just reached. If gambling, the way Natasha has explained it, exists in most states, why go to Las Vegas? And so he upped the ante considerably. You have to have spectacular entertainment options, which they now have. You have to bring all the celebrity chefs to Las Vegas. And you need to have really upscale hotels for that very reason that you talked about. They had to really up the ante.
I felt, though, somewhat vaguely ridiculous, you know, the half-size Brooklyn Bridge, the half-size Eiffel Tower.
I wanted to make, I don't want to interrupt. It's in relation to this kind of imitation quality, there's been a lot of discussion in some circles of what an imitation life is all about. I mean, we buy food that the way your grandmother made it. So that, you know, there's something to that in Las Vegas. There's this sense that it's an imitation of something. It's a paradise. It's a lost world. It's an idealized world that doesn't exist. And I think most of the people who go there know it. They aren't bothered by it. They're enjoying it just as they love going through a modern market here and with all of these products that that advertise their authenticity, their traditional quality, and we accept the fact that this is a manufactured image of an idealized.
Isn't there
past.
A problem with that? That this is
well,
this?
I'd actually add on to that
I'm
and argue
about
that
this, yeah.
The inauthenticity and sort of imitation aspect of Las Vegas has become authentic Las Vegas in itself. So you go there to have, and you can say this is a real Las Vegas experience, by which you mean this kind of simulacra of so many other
things. But isn't that what the philosopher Baudrillard noticed
exactly.
when he wrote in the book right. America? But to me, there's something, I guess because I still am rooted, having been born in 1950, in some sort of illusion of authenticity. And to me, there's a certain campiness and a certain inauthenticity. And I know as I use these words, they're antiquated, but there's something about this constantly repetitive image of repetition that begins to pose, like in that Orson Welles film where you never know what's the mirror and what's real, that begins to get me shaky and nervous, as if somehow the sense of being human is sacrificed on the altar of repetition.
Ah, Mark, just relax. It'll be fine.
Let's get a question from the audience. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Hi, I'm John from Providence. During the late 60s, when states start looking around for more revenue, they considered gambling and lotteries as a source of revenue. And at that time, J. Edgar Hoover sent around personnel to all the governor's offices and said, please don't do this. This will bring in organized crime and it will promote vice. And actually, the opposite occurred. It broke the back of the organized crime. And my question is twofold. One, what is there any residual role left in Las Vegas now for the mob that Mark just mentioned? But my second question is, what does Las Vegas foretell for the American experience with the legitimization of gambling, prostitution, and eventually liberalization of drugs?
Good question. The mob was clearly significant in Las Vegas from the mid-1940s through the mid-1980s. It would be hard to find a hotel casino in those four decades that was not linked in some way to organized crime. Not all of them were, but many, if not most of them, were linked.
How did they find a way into Las Vegas? What was the relationship that they had?
Well, let me go back to the word utopia. If you're in organized crime in the 1920s, you're making most of your money in an illegal venue. That's bootlegging during Prohibition. When Prohibition's over, you're looking for some other way to make money, and it's going to be illegal gaming or prostitution. Well, when Las Vegas becomes significant in the mid-1940s, this becomes the road to legitimacy. And the man who takes that lead is Benjamin Bugsy Siegel. I've interviewed his eldest daughter four or five times, and she recalled the last conversation she had with her father, and this was in the fall of 1946, and he told her that very thing. This is my chance. That other life can be behind me because all of this is legal in the state of Nevada. The Flamingo Hotel is my path to legitimacy. If you follow the lives of others who went there, Davy Berman from Minnesota or Mo Dalitz from Cleveland, they had the same sense, and Mo Dalitz became a community leader in Las Vegas. He was man of the year. What removes organized crime from Las Vegas is essentially two things. Really effective federal prosecution was one, but also corporate money was the other. The mob, as much money as they had, could not compete with corporate money.
And in as far as being a harbinger of other forms of gambling throughout the country or what would have been previously called, quote, vices?
There's a wonderful book called Suburban Xanadu by David Schwartz. And what he does is to take you from early after World War II up to the present. And most people who liked to gamble didn't want gambling in their neighborhood, but they wanted to gamble, and they liked the idea of this isolated place in the desert somewhere in the Southwest where they could go for a four-day, three-night package, have that experience, and go back home, and organized crime's not going to be there. But it begins to spread, beginning with New Jersey, which legalizes gambling, and then wherever you go now, you can find a casino that's run by Native Americans, notably in the state of Oklahoma. They're almost on every street corner in the state of Oklahoma. But it's even gone further, and the technology piece is really an important one. We're on the cusp of legal internet gambling. It's now, there are some casinos in Las Vegas that are pioneering in that, and I think we're very, very close to that. And all the elements that Natasha's talking about are going to be exacerbated by internet gambling.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to get into exactly how these casinos are organized to basically take your money from you. And what does it mean when you are pacified instead of exhilarated? What does it mean? Where does it come from? Why do we care about this being the way in which these casinos are organized? What does it mean for America and its future? I'm Mark Levitt, and you're listening to Action Speaks, Underappreciated 20th Century Dates That Changed America. Our media sponsors are the Providence Phoenix and Rhode Island PBS. You can check out our show's archive on our website, actionspeaksradio.org. That's actionspeaksradio.org, where you can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Hi, I'm Mark Levitt. Welcome back. And today on Action Speaks, we're looking at the 1941 opening of El Rancho Vegas, the first hotel on what would be called the Strip, and how Las Vegas fits into our collective imagination as a utopia or as a dystopia. Our guests today are Dr. Larry Craig, Chairman, Department of History and Political Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology, and the author of Bright Lights City, Las Vegas and Popular Culture, Natasha Schull, a cultural anthropologist and associate professor at MIT Program of Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, and Professor Dave Constan. He's a professor of classics at NYU and the author of many, many books, his last being Before Forgiveness, The Origins of a Moral Idea. Let's take a question from the audience, and then we're going to get to a little bit about the history of Las Vegas. Name and where you're from?
Hi, name's Ricardo. People know me as Dingo here in Providence. Going back to the idea of zoning out that Ms. Schull brought up, do you guys think that gambling, traditional gambling, has met its match with now what is video gaming with the XY and the millennials being in their homes where it's so comfortable doing this zoning out, this repetitive, predictable reward? And do you think also, Mr. Gregg, that is the internet, is this idea of trying to get to the internet their way of trying to reach that group or just try to reach the remnants of the adults as they die off and, you know, wither away into extinction as the conventional gambler?
Well, I will go first just because you used the word extinction. That's a word that is bandied about a lot if you go to these big technology conventions. Player extinction essentially means they're not using the term in the psychological sense of the extinction of a behavior, like an extinction of an addiction, but actually the extinction of funds. And they're very upfront about it. I mean, we may think this is sinister, but it's not secretive. Among themselves, they speak openly. It's about getting people to gamble longer, faster, and more. It just so happens that technology is a lot better at doing that than live games.
Larry Craig, the...
Can I answer the second part
please,
of this question?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
The idea of why moving to the internet, there is this concern about losing the biggest generation of gamblers. How do you attract the 21 to 30-year-olds? And there has been a move in the last decade to come up with ultra lounges, which is a way on the weekends, Friday nights, Saturday nights, to bring Southern Californians over to Las Vegas because it's my generation that they're losing. And they're trying to replace that with these other techniques.
Now, Las Vegas evolved from this kind of place where
the workers at the Hoover Dam sort of let off steam, and then sort of began to develop as a gambling mecca with the legalization of gambling in Nevada around 1931.
Wide open gambling, except for betting on horse races. That came in 41.
Then most of the casinos were downtown. And then El Rancho Vegas was the first casino out on what became the Strip. Mm-hmm. And the next evolution of that was really Bugsy Siegel's casino.
Well, there were two. The Hotel Last Frontier opened up in 1942. And Siegel, who was interested in Las Vegas from 1941, he'd invested in a downtown casino called the El Cortez, but he did have control of the race wire business. And he stole an idea that a Hollywood reporter editor named Billy Wilkerson had to build this Monte Carlo-like experience. He took over the Flamingo project, and it became his project. And that's really the end. Well, not really the end. It's the near end of the Wild West theme for Las Vegas hotels, and then you come into a more modern era where there's going to be the Desert Inn, the Sahara, the Sands.
And the corporatization began around 1980 or so?
Well, there's a piece of legislation in 1969 that really opens up corporate investment into Las Vegas. Prior to that time, if the three of us wanted to start a casino, our lives would have to be thoroughly documented. Do we have any connection to organized crime in our background? But if it's corporate investment, you can't investigate every stockholder. So it's really the beginning is the early 1970s.
Of course, in that legislation, they grandfathered people that were already in Las Vegas who had connections to the mob. Mm-hmm. And then it became more corporate. The larger and larger hotels began to grow higher and higher. And this kind of new form of gambling, the way Natasha Schull talks about it, began around 1990, would it be?
And the problem here, I'm going to step on your answer, is that gambling becomes ever less important in their income. Now gambling is less than half the income for the hotels.
This is often called the shift, the Disneyfication of Las Vegas, the shift from vice to nice, the setting up of daycare sites, so that you can bring your kids along.
I want to try it, Mommy.
Well, you see where the kids are playing, and they're basically versions of slot machines and putting in the coins. But you also see things, if you really look at how this change from vice to nice is showing up, it's also showing up in places like hotel room design. Formerly, the logic was you want to get people out and onto the casino floor. You don't want them in their rooms at all. Get them out of their rooms. But they'd often have uncomfortable beds, really garish wallpaper, like green neon stripes, sort of like a bad little rat cage up there. And they wanted you out. And then there was this whole sea change and a shift to suburban, comfortable decor. I mean, it was okay to stay in your room, stay longer. It was a shift to a profit logic of volume. Sometimes it's called the Costco formula for gambling.
I'm fascinated, because I'm no historian of Las Vegas, at how the city has managed to transform itself from one epoch to another. It's like a really healthy virus. It is... It's a model of survival. Great architecture, art, cuisine has always been, the avant-garde for it has always been royal courts. You know, it's in Louis XIV's palace that you're going to find the best chefs in France and the most inventive and the ones whose recipes will then trickle down. And Las Vegas is doing some of that. When you see the competition among restaurants, the competition among designers, I mean, think really what it takes, the talent it takes, to produce the decor in these hotels. If you strip away the sense of guilt at being in an imitative environment that Mark can feel on behalf of all of us, and then just enjoy it, it really is extraordinary.
Dr. Constan, do you want to talk about that you're paid for by the Las Vegas Tourist Bureau here? We have a question from the audience.
My name's Alan. I'm from Providence. And I'm curious if anybody has any experience with the, I guess to contextualize this a little bit, I lean towards dystopia on the gambling thing. And I'm just curious about the effects of this day after day after day on the employees that work around it.
Well, that has a dystopic but also a utopic aspect to it. We were talking before about gender and the problems that still linger there and inequities, you could say. But I don't know if anybody saw the recent, I think it was the New York Times piece on the states that have the most egregious difference in salaries. And I think Nevada was up there with the sort of most equitable. In Nevada, it's possible to send your kids to college as a single mom and buy your own house as a maid, because there's a really strong union. There's an incredibly strong culinary union. I mean, Las Vegas has such a rich labor history, which Larry probably can speak to more than I can. But, you know, a valet makes $77,000 a year, not including tips.
Larry? A follow-up to that question, I got to know one of the casino managers for a few years until he retired. And I asked him once, how do you deal with compulsive gamblers? And he said, it's a real struggle because we don't want compulsive gamblers. That's bad business for us. And I said, well, I don't think I've seen any compulsive gamblers in here since I've been in your casino. He said, there's one right over there. And there was a guy playing dollar slot machines three at a time. And he said, this fellow has lost all of his money. We stopped cashing his checks. We've advised him not to come into the casino, but we can't keep him from coming into the casino. He said, sometimes I even put him up in a room so he's got a place to sleep. Now, that's not true of every casino manager. Some are more hard-hearted than that, but it does have an impact on those who work and see the ill effects of the gambling, particularly the compulsive gambling.
And just one note on that, the proportion of addiction among those who work is much higher than the general population. I think it's 20%. And, you know, GA, Gamblers Anonymous, follows the rules of AA very closely. So in AA, you're not supposed to go to bars or anywhere sort of near stuff. And so you're not supposed to go near gambling establishments. That's impossible in Las Vegas. People will come to Gamblers Anonymous meetings wearing their casino garb. They're dealers very often, or cocktail waitresses.
Question from the audience. Name and where you're from.
My name is John. I'm from South Kingston. I would be leaning towards dystopia. I flew over Las Vegas last year coming back from Portland, and it's just in the middle of the desert, and it's just endless flat roofs or just, you know, earthen roofs. And I just thought, what is this place? What exactly is it? And it's been such an interesting conversation tonight on all the buttons that are pushed that bring people there. All the artists and designers and all the talent that comes there. What happens when we disregard our connection to the natural world and make it sort of an imperative thing to create economic wealth, and we disregard that? And the smartest, most talented people come there to create what is a dystopic vision. You can't continue to live in a place like that, given the population and the water resources.
I'd say what they're selling is this illusion to people that there can be this abundant, that there can be water in the desert, that you can go into a buffet and eat everything you want and feel great, or gamble and win. And I always remember when I was making the film on all-you-can-eat buffets, somebody really thought about it. I mean, I got some profound insights, existential insights from these buffet eaters, right? And he said to me, you know, after a buffet, I feel full but not satisfied. And that really, to me, captured the problematic aspect of this marketing of abundance, whether it's in the environment, in food. I mean, just thinking politically about the food that gets wasted, because you've got to keep your trays full till the changeover to the next meal. And you can't, then everyone's worried about liabilities. So this food is not going downtown to the homeless shelters. It's being thrown out and guarded so that nobody's taking it.
Can I address this gentleman's question directly? Currently, the dilemma in Las Vegas with handling your proposition is that it had probably the city with the second worst effects of the recent recession. Unemployment was extraordinarily high. There was such a high proportion of people whose mortgages were underwater. And it's really hard to tell that population we need to be more ecologically minded when they need jobs and when they need economic development. So it's really tough for the Clark County leaders and the city of Las Vegas leaders to do exactly what you're saying, because they got folks saying, no, we need more jobs.
Natasha, this anesthetization of people as they play these machines, for lack of a better term, it seems to have coincided with a change in the United States, a change from maybe the sort of the gambling instinct of the rugged individualist, of the possibilities of transcending the lower class and becoming middle class and then the upper class. It seems to coincide with a moment in the United States when we're beginning to really feel the effects of globalization and the sort of seismic shifts that are going on underneath people, and the sense of anxiety that's attendant to that notion, conscious or not, that we're living in a world of unpredictability. Do you see any connection between those?
Absolutely. I mean, as a cultural anthropologist, that's really where I ended up in my research and my argument. And it came across clearly in the extensive interviews I did with gamblers that this escape they sought in machines was somehow related to the anxieties and uncertainties and great disillusionments that they had in their day-to-day lives. And that's why the words of this one gambler resonated so strongly with me. That, you know, if I wanted unpredictability and danger, I have enough of that in the real world. Here I come to seek some kind of calm zone.
Today we've been speaking about the first casino hotel on the Las Vegas Strip, El Rancho Vegas, opening in 1941 and heralding in an unprecedented boom of chance and pleasure-seeking that has continued to play to this day. Las Vegas, utopia or dystopia, you put your money down and you take a chance.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through.
Our panelists tonight have been Larry Craig, Chair, Department of History and Political Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology, and the author of Bright Light City, Las Vegas in Popular Culture. Natasha Schull, Cultural Anthropologist and Associate Professor at MIT's Program in Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. Her documentary film, Buffet, All You Can Eat, Las Vegas, has screened multiple times on PBS and appeared in numerous film festivals. And Dave Constant is a professor of classics at NYU and is the author of many books, his last being Before Forgiveness, The Origins of a Moral Idea. Before coming to NYU, Dr. Constant taught at Brown between 1987 and 2010, where he was the John Rowe Workman Distinguished Professor of Classics and the Humanistic Tradition and Professor in Comparative Literature. You've been listening to Action Speaks, produced at AS220, funded in part by the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities and the law firm of Robinson and Cole. We thank as well our media partners, the Providence Phoenix and Rhode Island PBS. Check out the schedule for Rhode Island's PBS accompanying films, our archives, our podcasts, friend us, or sign up for our Twitter feed on our website, www.actionspeaksradio.org. Thanks as well to my co-executive producer, Bert Krenker, our managing producer, Jacqueline Frohl, our senior radio producer, James Moses, webmaster photographer, Vera Levitt, our house manager, Marilee Armstrong, and our production managers, Zach Drummond and Jacob Nathan. Thanks as well to our interns, Molly Kecker and Caitlin Kennedy, and to our podcast engineer, Chris Anderson. I'm Mark Levitt, wishing you health, happiness, and as much surprise as you need, and a little more than you think you can handle. Thank you all very much.
Viva Las Vegas! Viva!